Penguin Audio presents Skin Game by Jim Butcher. Read by James Marsters. Chapter 1. There was a ticking time bomb inside my head, and the one person I trusted to go in and get it out hadn't shown up or spoken to me for more than a year. That's a lot of time to start asking yourself questions. Who am I? What have I done with my life? Who can I trust? That last one is a doozy. It haunts you in moments of doubt. Sometimes when you wake up at night, you wonder if you've put your faith in the right people. Sometimes when you find yourself alone, for whatever reason, you review every little thing you know about someone, searching your memory for small, subtle things that you may have missed about them. It makes you scared. It makes you think that maybe you've made some horrible mistakes lately. It drives you to do something, to act. Only when you're stuck on an island in the middle of Lake Michigan, you're kind of limited in your choices of exactly what you can do to blow off steam. I'd gone with my usual option. I was running through long tunnels filled with demons and monsters and nightmares because it was easier than going to the gym. The tunnels were big, the size of some of the sub-streets beneath the city of Chicago. Their walls made of earth and stone, wound through with things that looked like roots but could not possibly belong to any tree this deep in the earth. Every few yards, more or less, at random, there was a mound of luminous pale green quartz crystals. Inside every crystal mound was a recumbent, shadowy form. Some of the mounds held figures no larger than a medium-sized dog. Some of them were the size of houses. I had just finished climbing over one of the huge mounds and was sprinting toward the next, the first in a series of three mounds, more or less, the size of my deceased Volkswagen.
Parkour!
I shouted and leapt, hitting the top of the mound with my hands and vaulting over it. I landed on the far side, dropping into a forward roll over one shoulder, and came up running.
Parkour!
I shouted at the next mound, putting one hand down as I leapt, using it to guide my body up to the horizontal at the same level as my head, clearing the next mound, landing, and staying on the move.
Parkour!
I screamed again at the third and simply dove over it in a long arc. The idea was to clear it, land on my hands, drop into a smooth roll, and come up running again, but it didn't work out that way.
I misjudged the dive. My foot caught a crystal, and I belly flopped and planted my face in the dirt on the far side of the mound. I lay there on the ground for a moment, getting back the wind I'd knocked out of myself. Taking a fall wasn't a big deal. God knows I've done it enough. I rolled over onto my back and groaned,
"Harry, you've got way too much time on your hands."
My voice echoed through the tunnel, number 7 of 13.
"Parkour!"
said a distant echo. I shook my head, pushed myself up, and started walking out. Walking through one of the tunnels beneath the island of Demon Reach was always an experience. When I ran, I went by the mounds pretty quick. When I walked, the prisoners trapped inside them had time to talk to me.
"Let me fulfill your every desire,"
crooned a silken voice in my head as I went by one.
"Blood and power, riches and strength, I can give you all that you,"
promised the next.
"One day, mortal, I will be free and suck the marrow from your bones," snarled another.
"Bow down in fear and horror before me.
Loathe me, let me devour you, and I will make real your dreams.
Release me, or I will destroy you!"
"Go to sleep, go to sleep, sleep and let me inside you.
blood, pain, death, blood, flesh, blood, pain, death.
Blagel slog, north hagel flan.
You know, the usual. I skirted around a fairly small mound whose occupant had simply sent me a mental picture that had kept me up for a couple of nights the last time I walked by, and passed one of the last mounds before the exit. As I walked by, the mound's occupant projected a mental sigh and an unmistakable image of a man rolling his eyes.
Ah, a new one.
I paused and studied the mound. As a rule, I didn't communicate with the prisoners. If you were locked up under demon reach, you were a nightmare, the likes of which few people could really understand. Immortal, savage, and probably foaming at the mouth, hair on fire, crazy to boot. But I'd been locked up almost as well as the prisoners for months, trapped on the island and in the caverns beneath. There wasn't a lot of choice. Until I got the thing in my head out again, only the island had the power to keep it in check. I had visitors sometimes, but the winter months were dangerous on Lake Michigan, both because of the weather and because of the ice, and spring had only barely begun to touch the world again. It had been a while since I'd seen anyone. So I eyed the mound, one about the size of a coffin, and said, "What's your problem?"
"You, obviously," replied the occupant. "Do you even know what the word stasis means? It means nothing is happening. You standing here, walking by, talking to me, for God's sake, buggers that up entirely, the way you novices always do. What was the phrase? Ah, yes. Piss off."
I lifted my eyebrows. To date, every single prisoner who had tried to communicate with me had been pretty obviously playing to get out, or else howling nuts. This guy just sounded British. "Huh," I said.
"Did you hear me, Warden? Piss off."
I debated taking him literally, just to be a wise ass, but decided that body humor was beneath the dignity of a wizard of the White Council and the Warden of Demon Reach, thus disproving everyone who says I am nothing but an overgrown juvenile delinquent. "Who are you?" I asked instead. There was a long moment of silence, and then a thought filled with a terrible weariness and purely emotional anguish, like something I'd experienced only at the very lowest moments of my life, flowed into me. But for this being, such pain wasn't a low point. It was a constant state.
"Someone who needs to be here. Go away, boy."
A rolling wave of nausea went through me. The air was suddenly too bright, the gentle glow of the crystals too piercing. I found myself taking several steps back from the mound until that awful tide of feeling had receded, but the headache those emotions had triggered found me nonetheless, and I was abruptly in too much pain to keep my feet. I dropped to one knee, clenching my teeth on a scream. The headaches had gotten steadily worse, and despite a lifetime of learning to cope with pain, despite the power of the mantle of the winter night, they had begun kicking my ass thoroughly a few weeks before. For a while, there was simply pain and aching, racking nausea. Eventually, that began to grow slowly less, and I looked up to see a hulking form in a dark cloak standing over me. It was 10 or 12 feet tall, and built on the same scale as a massively muscled human, though I never really seemed to see much of the being beneath the cloak. It stared down at me, a pair of pinpoints of green fiery light serving as eyes within the depths of its hood.
"Warden," it said, its voice a deep rumble, "I have suppressed the parasite for now."
"About time, Alfred," I muttered. I sat up and took stock of myself.
I'd been lying there for a while. The sweat on my skin had dried. That was bad. The ancient spirit of the island had been keeping the thing in my skull from killing me for a year. Until a few weeks ago, when my head started hurting, all it had to do was show up, speak a word, and the pain would go away. This time, it had taken more than an hour. Whatever was in my head, some kind of psychic or spiritual creature that was using me to grow, was getting ready to kill me.
Alfred, the spirit said soberly, is this to be my new name?
Let's stick with Demon Reach, I said. The enormous spirit considered that.
I am the island.
Well, yes, I said, gathering myself to my feet. It's spirit, it's genius Loki.
And I am also separate from the island, a vessel.
I eyed the spirit. You know the name Alfred is a joke, right? It stared at me. The wind that didn't exist stirred the hem of its cloak. I raised my hands in surrender and said, All right, I guess you need a first name, too. Alfred Demonreach it is. Its eyes flickered brighter for a moment, and it inclined its head to me within the hood. Then it said,
She is here.
I jerked my head up, my heart suddenly speeding. It made little echoes of pain go through my head. Had she finally responded to my messages? Molly?
Not Grasshopper. Grasshopper's new mother.
I felt tension slide into my shoulders and neck. Mab, I said in a low, hard voice.
Yes.
Fantastic, I muttered. Mab, the queen of air and darkness, monarch of the winter court of the Shi, mistress and mentor of every wicked being and fairy, my boss, had been ignoring me for months. I'd been sending her messages on an increasingly regular basis to no avail, at least not until today. But why now? Why show up now after all those months of silence? Because, dummy, I muttered to myself, she wants something. I turned to Demon Reach. Okay, Alfred, where?
Doc.
Which was smart. Demon Reach, like practically every prison ever, was just as well suited to keeping visitors out as it was to keeping them in. When a freaking walker of the outside and his posse had shown up to perform a massive jailbreak on the island's prisoners, they had been beaten back, thanks to the efforts of the island's defenses and several key allies. I'd spent the last year acquainting myself with the island's secrets, with the defenses that I hadn't even known existed, defenses that could be activated only by the warden. If the walker tried that play again, I could shut him down single-handed. Even Mab, as powerful as she was, would be well advised to be cautious if she decided to start trouble on Demon Reach's soil. Which was why she was standing on the dock. She expected me to be upset. Definitely she wanted something. In my experience, when the Queen of Air and Darkness decides she wants something from you, it's a good time to crawl in a hole and pull it in after you. But my head pulsed with little twinges of pain. My headaches had slowly gotten worse and worse over several years, and I had only recently discovered their cause. I had a condition that had to be taken care of before whatever was hanging out in my noggin decided to burst its way out of my skull. I didn't dare to leave the island until that happened, and if Mab had finally decided to respond to my messages, I had little choice but to meet with her. Which was probably why she hadn't shown up to talk to me until now. Freaking manipulative fairies, I muttered under my breath. Then I headed for the stairs leading out of the well and up to the island surface. Stay nearby and pay attention, I told Demon Reach.
Do you suspect she means you harm?
Huh, I said, starting up the stairs. One way or another. Let's go. Chapter 2 My brother and I had built the What's Up dock down at the shore at one of Demon Reach's three little beaches, the one nearest the opening in the stone reefs surrounding the island. There had been a town on the hillside up above the beach maybe a century before, but it had been abandoned after its residents had apparently been driven slowly bonkers by all the dark energy around the hideous things imprisoned below the island. The ruins of the town were still there, half swallowed by the forest, a corpse being slowly devoured by fungus and moss. I sometimes wondered how long I could stay on the damned island before I was bonkers too. There was an expensive motored yacht tied to the dock, as out of place as a Ferrari in a cattle yard, white with a lot of frosty blue chrome. There were a couple of hands in sight, and they weren't dressed in sailing clothes so much as they were in sailing costumes. The creases were too straight, the clothes too clean, the fit too perfect. Watching them move, I had no doubt they were carrying weapons and practiced in killing. They were she, the lords of fairy, tall and beautiful and dangerous. They didn't impress me. Mostly because they weren't nearly as pretty or dangerous as the woman standing at the very end of my dock, the tips of her expensive shoes half an inch from Demon Reach's shore. When there's a great white shark in the water with you, it's tough to be worried about a couple of barracuda swimming along behind her. Mab, the queen of air and darkness, was wearing a tailored business suit somewhere between the color of smeared charcoal on newsprint and frozen periwinkles. The blouse beneath was snow-white, like her hair, which was bound up in an elaborate do that belonged in the 40s. Opals flashed on her ears and at her throat, deep colors of green and blue, matching the shifting hues of her cold, flat eyes. She was pale, beautiful on a scale that beggared simple description, and I harbored a healthy and rational terror of her. I came down the old stone steps in the hillside to the dock and stopped an arm's length away from Mab. I didn't bow to her, but I inclined my head formally. There were other she there on the boat witnessing the meeting, and I had worked out a while ago that though I was no danger to Mab's pride, she would not tolerate disrespect to her office. I was pretty sure that if the Winter Knight openly defied her in front of her court, it would basically be a declaration of war, and despite what I now knew about the island, I wanted nothing of the sort with Mab. "My queen," I said pleasantly, "how's Trix?"
"Functioning flawlessly, my knight," she replied. "As ever, get on the boat."
"Why?" I asked. Her mouth turned down into a slight frown, but it was belied by the sudden pleased light in her eyes.
"I'm predictable, aren't I?" I asked her.
"In many ways," she replied. "Shall I answer you literally?"
"I'd like that."
Mab nodded, then she leaned forward very slightly, her eyes growing deep, and said in a voice colder and harder than frozen stone,
"Because I told you to do so."
I swallowed, and my stomach did this little roller coaster number on me.
"What happens if I won't?" I asked.
"You have already made clear to me that you will resist me if I attempt to compel you directly to obey my commands," Mab said. "Such a thing would render you useless to me, and for the moment, I would find it inconvenient to train a replacement. I would therefore do nothing."
I blinked at that. "Nothing? I could deny you and you just go?"
"Indeed," Mab said, turning. "You will be dead in 3 days, by which time I should have made arrangements to replace you."
I said, "What?" Mab paused and looked over her shoulder.
"The parasite within you will emerge in that time. Surely you have noticed the pains growing worse."
Boy, had I, and it added up. "Damn it," I snarled, keeping my voice too low to be heard by the goons on the boat. You set me up. Mab turned to face me and gave me a very small smile. I've been sending out Toot and Lacuna with messages for you and Molly every damn day. None of them got through, did they?
They are fairies, Mab said. I am a queen of fairy.
And my sendings to Molly?
I wove nets to catch any spells leaving this island the moment I bade you farewell, my knight, she said. And the messages you sent to her through your friends were altered to suit my needs. I find it useful how the tiniest amount of distrust creates so much opportunity for miscommunication. Your friends have been trying to visit you for several weeks, but the lake ice has held unusually long this year. Alas.
I ground my teeth. You knew I needed her help.
And, she said, biting the words off crisply, you still do.
3 days. Hell's bells. Have you ever considered just asking me for my help? I asked her. Maybe even saying, please?
She arched a pale eyebrow at me. I am not your client.
So you just go straight to extortion?
I cannot compel you, she said in a reasonable tone. I must therefore see to it that circumstance does. You cannot leave this island without being incapacitated by pain. You cannot send for help unless I allow it. Your time has all but run out, my knight.
I found myself speaking through clenched teeth. Why would you put me in a corner like this?
Perhaps because it is necessary. Perhaps it is to protect you from yourself.
Her eyes flashed with the distant fury of a thunderstorm on the horizon.
Or perhaps it is simply because I can. In the end, it does not matter why. All that matters is what is.
I inhaled and exhaled a few times to keep the anger from boiling out into my voice. Given what she had to manage, it was entirely possible that manipulating me and threatening me with death this way was asking politely, by the standards of Mab, anyway. But that didn't mean I had to like it. Besides, she was right. If Mab said I had 3 days to live, she meant it. She had neither the capability nor the need to speak any direct lies. And if that was true, which I felt depressingly confident it was, then she had me over a barrel. What do you want? I asked. I almost sounded polite.
The question brought a pleased smile to her lips and a nod that looked suspiciously like one of approval. I wish you to perform a task for me.
This task, I said, would it happen to be off the island?
Obviously.
I pointed a finger at my temple. Then we have an issue with the incapacitated by pain thing. You'll have to fix me first.
If I did, you'd never agree to it, Mab said calmly. And I would then be obliged to replace you.
For your own health and safety, therefore, you will wear this instead. She lifted her hand and held it out to me, palm up. There was a small stone in her palm, a deep blue opal. I leaned a little closer, eyeing it. It was set on a silver stud, an earring.
It should suffice to contain the parasite for what time remains, Mab said. Put it on.
My ears aren't pierced, I objected. Mab arched an eyebrow.
Are you the Winter Knight or some sort of puling child?
I scowled at her. Come over here and say that. At that, Mab calmly stepped onto the shore of Demon Reach until her toes were almost touching mine. She was several inches over 6 feet tall and barely had to reach up to take my earlobe in her fingers. Wait, I said, wait. She paused. The left one. Mab tilted her head.
Why?
Look, it's a mortal thing. Just do the left one, okay? She exhaled briefly through her nose, then she shook her head and changed ears.
There was a pinpoint of red-hot pain in my left earlobe, and then a slow pulse of lazy, almost seductive cold, like the air on an autumn night when you open the bedroom windows and sleep like a rock. There, Mab said, fixing the post in place. Was that such a trial? I glowered and reached up to the stone with my left hand. My fingertips confirmed what my ears had reported. It felt physically cold to the touch. Now that I've got this to keep me safe off the island, I said very quietly, what's to stop me from having Alfred drop you into a cell right this second and solving my problems myself? I am, Mab said. She gave me a very small, very chill smile and held up her finger. There was a tiny droplet of my blood upon it, scarlet against her pale skin. The consequences to your mortal world, should there be no Mab, would be dire. The consequences to yourself, should you try it, even more so. Try me, wizard. I am willing. For a second I thought about it. She was stacking up enough leverage on me that whatever it was she wanted me to do, I was sure I was going to hate it. I never wanted to be in Mab's ongoing service anyway. The boss couldn't be the boss if I imprisoned her in crystal hundreds of feet beneath the waters of Lake Michigan. And it wasn't like she hadn't earned some time in the cooler. Mab was a serious bad guy. Except she was our serious bad guy. As cruel and as horrible as she could be, she was a guardian who protected the world from things that were even worse. Suddenly, removing her from that balance of power could be worse than catastrophic. And admit it to yourself, at least, Dresden. You're scared. What if you tried to take her down and missed? Remember what happened to the last guy who betrayed Mab? You've never beaten her. You've never come close. I didn't let myself shudder. She would have seen it as weakness, and that isn't a wise thing to show any fairy. I just exhaled and looked away from those cold, endless eyes. Mab inclined her head to me, barely, a victor's acknowledgement. Then she turned and walked back onto the dock. Bring anything you may need. We leave at once. Chapter 3 Mab's yacht took us to Belmont Harbor, where the late February ice had evidently been broken up by an unseasonably warm morning. My ear throbbed with occasional cold, but my head seemed fine, and when we docked, I hopped over the rail and onto the pier with a large duffel bag in one hand and my new wizard's staff in the other. Mab descended the gangplank with dignity and eyed me. Parkour, I explained. Appointment, she said, gliding by me. A limo was waiting for us, complete with two more she and bodyguard costumes. They swept us into the city proper down Lakeshore Drive until we hit the loop, turned, and pulled up in front of the Carbide and Carbon building, a vast charcoal-colored creation that always reminded me of the monolith in 2001, except for all the brassy filigree. I'd always thought it looked particularly baroque and cool, and then it had become the Hard Rock Hotel. Two additional she bodyguards were waiting when we pulled up, tall and inhumanly beautiful. Between one step and the next, they all changed from a crowd of cover models into lantern-jawed thugs with buzz cuts and earpieces. Glamour, the legendary power of fairy illusion. Mab did not bother altering her own appearance, save for donning a pair of designer sunglasses. The four goons fell into a square formation around us as we went in, and we all marched up to an awaiting elevator. The numbers rolled swiftly up to the top floor, and then went one floor above that one. The doors opened onto an extravagant penthouse loft. Mozart floated in from speakers of such quality that for a moment I assumed that live musicians must be present. Floor to 14-foot ceiling windows gave us a sweeping view of the lake and the shoreline south of the hotel. The floors were made of polished hardwood. Tropical trees had been planted throughout the room. along with bright flowering plants that were busy committing the olfactory floral equivalent of aggravated assault. Furniture sets were scattered around the place, some on the floor and some on platforms, sitting at various levels. There was a bar and a small stage with a sound system, and at the far end of the loft, stairs led up to an elevated platform, which, judging from the bed, must have served as a bedroom. There were also 5 goons wearing black suits with matching shotguns waiting for us outside of the elevator doors. As the doors opened, the goons worked the actions on their weapons, but did not precisely raise them to aim at us. "Ma'am," said one of them, much younger than the others, "please identify yourself." Mab stared at them impassively through her sunglasses. Then, in a motion so slight that I doubt any of them noticed, she twitched one eyebrow. I grunted, flicked a hand, and muttered, "Infriga." I didn't put much power into the spell, but it was enough to make the point. A sudden thick layer of rime crackled into being over the lower 2/3 of the goons' bodies, covering their boots and guns and the hands holding them. The men twitched in surprise and let out little hisses of discomfort, but did not relinquish the weapons. "The lady doesn't do lackeys," I told them, "and you damn well know who she is. Whichever one of you chuckleheads is holding the brain should probably go tell your boss she's here before she starts feeling offended." The young goon who had spoken staggered away, deeper into the loft, around a screen of trees and flowers, while the others faced us, dispassionate and clearly uncomfortable. Mab eyed me and said in an intimate whisper, "What was that?" I answered in kind, "I'm not killing a mortal just to make a point." "You were willing enough to kill one of my she for that reason." "I play on your team," I told her. "I'm not from your town." She looked up at me over the rims of her sunglasses and then said, "Squeamishness does not become the winter night." "It's not about squeam, Mab," I said. "No," she said, "it is about weakness." "Yeah, well," I said, facing front again, "I'm only human." Mab's gaze remained on me, cold and heavy as a blanket of snow. "For now." I didn't shiver. I get muscle twitches sometimes, that's all. The goon, capable of human speech, returned and was careful not to make eye contact with anyone as he bowed at the waist in Mab's general direction. "Your Majesty, please proceed. Your 4 guards may wait here with these 4, and I will show you to him." Mab did not so much as twitch to acknowledge that the goon had spoken. She just stepped out of the elevator smartly, her heels clicking with metronomic inevitability on the hard floor, and both the goon and I hurried to keep pace with her. We walked around the screen of shrubbery where the goon had gone a moment before and found an elaborate raised platform with 3 wide steps leading up to it. The whole thing was thickly surrounded by more plant life, giving it the cozy feel of an alcove. Expensive living room furniture was spaced around it ideally for conversation, and that's where Mab's appointment was waiting for us. "Sir," the goon said, "Her Majesty, Queen Mab, and the Winter Knight."
"Who needs no introduction,"
said a man with a deep, resonant voice. I recognized it. That voice had once been smooth and flowing, but now there was a hint of rasp to it, a roughness that wasn't there before, like silk gliding over old gravel. A man of medium height and build rose from his chair. He was dressed in a black silk suit, a black shirt, and a worn gray tie. He had dark hair threaded with silver, dark eyes, and he moved with the coiled grace of a snake. There was a smile on his mouth, but not in his eyes, as he faced me.
"Well, well, well. Harry Dresden."
"Nicodemus Arcleon," I slurred into a Connery accent.
"My cut has improved your voice."
Something ugly flickered far back in his eyes, and his voice might have grown a little rougher, but his smile never wavered.
"You came closer than anyone has in a long,
long time.
Maybe you're starting to slip in your old age, I said. It's the little things that go first. For instance, you missed taking the tongue out of one of your goons. You're going to make him feel left out if he's the only one who can talk. That made Nicodemus smile more deeply. I'd met his gang of hangers-on before. They'd all had their tongues cut out.
He turned to Mab and bowed at the waist, the gesture more elegant than anything I could manage, the manners of another time.
Your Majesty?
Nicodemus, Mad said in a frosty tone, then in a more neutral one, Anduriel. Nicodemus didn't move, but his freaking shadow inclined its head anyway. No matter how many times I saw that kind of action, it still creeped me out. Nicodemus was a knight of the Blackened Denarius, or maybe it was more accurate to say that he was the knight of the Blackened Denarius. He had one of 30 silver coins on him somewhere, one that contained the essence of the fallen angel Anduriel. The Denarians were bad news in a major way. Even though angels were sharply curtailed in how they were allowed to use their power, hobbled and bound to a mortal partner, they were as dangerous as anything running around in the shadows, and when they teamed up with world-class lunatics like Nicodemus, they were several shades worse. Nicodemus, as far as I'd been able to find out, had been perpetrating outrages for a couple of millennia. He was smart, ruthless, tough, and killing people was almost as significant to him as throwing away an empty beer can. I'd survived him once. He'd survived me once. Neither of us had been able to put the other away. Yet.
I beg your indulgence for a moment, Nicodemus said to Mab. A minor matter of internal protocol to which I must attend before we continue.
There was a frozen micro-instant of displeasure before Mab answered.
Of course.
Nicodemus bowed again and then walked a few steps away and turned to the goon who had led us over. He beckoned to the man and said,
Brother Jordan, approach.
Jordan came to rigid military attention, swallowed, and then walked formally forward, stopping precisely in front of Nicodemus before bracing to attention again.
You have completed the trials of the Brotherhood, Nicodemus said, his voice warm. You have the highest recommendation of your fellows, and you have faced a dangerous foe with steadfast courage. It is my judgment that you have demonstrated your loyalty and commitment to our cause beyond the meager bonds of any oath.
He reached up and put a hand on the young man's shoulder.
Have you any final words?
The kid's eyes gleamed with sudden emotion, and his breathing sped.
I thank you, my lord.
Well said, Nicodemus murmured, smiling.
Then he said,
Deirdre?
The second person in the alcove rose from where she had been sitting quietly in the background. She was a young woman in a simple black dress. Her features were lean and severe, her body graced with the same slight, elegant curves as a straight razor. She had long, dark hair to go with black eyes that were a double of Nicodemus's own, and when she approached Jordan, she gave him an almost sisterly smile. And then she changed. First her eyes shifted, changing from dark orbs to pits filled with a burning crimson glow. A second set of eyes, these glowing green, blinked open above the first, and then her face contorted, the bones shifting. Her skin seemed to ripple and then hardened, darkening to an ugly deep purple of a fresh bruise, taking on the consistency of thick hide. The dress just seemed to shimmer out of existence, revealing legs that had contorted, her feet lengthening dramatically until they looked backward hinged. And her hair changed. It grew, slithering out of her scalp like dozens of writhing serpents, flattening into hard metallic ribbons of midnight black that rustled and stirred and rippled of their own volition. As that happened, Nicodemus's shadow simply grew, with no change in the light to prompt it. It stretched out behind him, and then up the wall, growing and growing until it spread over the whole of that side of the huge loft.
"Bear witness," Nicodemus said quietly, "as Brother Jordan becomes Squire Jordan."
The green eyes atop Deirdre's flickered brightly as Deirdre lifted claw-tipped hands to cup Jordan's face quite gently. Then she leaned forward and kissed him, lips parted. My stomach twisted and flipped over. I didn't let it show. Deirdre's head suddenly snapped forward a little more, and Jordan's body stiffened. A muffled scream escaped the seal of Deirdre's lips, but was quickly choked off. I saw Deirdre's jaws lock, and then she jerked her head away in a sudden, sharp motion of a shark ripping flesh from its prey. Her head fell back in something that looked horribly like ecstasy, and I could see the bloody flesh of Jordan's tongue gripped between her teeth. Blood fountained from the young man's mouth. He let out a wordless sound and staggered, falling to one knee. Deirdre's head jerked in swallowing motions, like a seabird downing a fish, and she made a quiet gulping sound. Then she shuddered and opened her burning eyes slowly. She turned to move deliberately to Nicodemus's side, her purplish lips black with blood, and murmured,
"It is done, Father."
Nicodemus kissed her on the mouth. And, my God, him doing it with tongue now was even more unsettling than it had been the first time I'd seen it. He lifted his mouth from Deirdre's a moment later and said,
"Rise, Squire Jordan."
The young man staggered to his feet, the lower half of his face a mass of blood dripping down over his chin and throat.
"Get some ice on that and see the medic, Squire," Nicodemus said. "Congratulations."
Jordan's eyes gleamed again and his mouth twisted into a macabre smile. Then he turned and hurried away, leaving a dripping trail of blood behind him. My stomach twisted. One of these days, I'm going to have to learn to keep my mouth shut. Nicodemus had just casually had a man maimed solely to make a point to me for teasing him about it. I clenched my jaw and resolved to use the incident to remind me exactly the kind of monster I was dealing with here.
"There," Nicodemus said, turning back to Mab. "I apologize for any inconvenience."
"Shall we conclude our business?" Mab said. "My time is valuable."
"Of course," Nicodemus said. "You know why I have approached you."
"Indeed," Mab said. "Anduriel once loaned me the services of his associate. I now repay that debt by loaning you the services of mine."
"Wait, what?" I said. "Excellent," Nicodemus said. He produced a business card and held it out. "Our little group will meet here at sundown."
Mab reached for the card and nodded. "Done." I intercepted her hand, taking the card before she could.
"Not done," I said. "I'm not working with a psychopath." "Sociopath, actually," Nicodemus said, "though for practical purposes the terms are nearly interchangeable."
"You're an ugly piece of work, and I don't trust you any farther than I can kick you, which I'm tempted to see how far I can do," I snapped back. I turned to Mab.
"Tell me you aren't serious."
"I," she said in a hard voice, "am perfectly serious. You will go with Arcleone. You will render him all aid and assistance until such time as he has completed his objective."
"What objective?" I demanded.
Mab looked at him. Nicodemus smiled at me.
"Nothing terribly complex. Difficult, to be sure, but not complicated. We're going to rob a vault."
"You don't need anyone to help you with that," I said. "You could handle any vault in the world."
"True," Nicodemus said. "But this vault is not of this world. It is, in fact, of the underworld."
"Underworld?" I asked.
I was getting a bad feeling about this.
Nicodemus gave me a bland smile.
Who? I asked him. Whose vault are you knocking over?
An ancient being of tremendous power, he replied in his roughened voice, his smile widening. You may know him as Hades, the Lord of the Underworld.
Hades, I said. The Hades? The Greek god?
The very same.
I looked slowly from Nicodemus to Mab. Her face was beautiful and absolute. The chill of the little earring that was keeping me alive pulsed steadily against my skin. Oh, I said quietly. Oh, hell's bells. Chapter 4. My brain shifted into overdrive. My back might have been against a wall, but that was hardly anything new. One thing I'd learned in long years of spine-to-brick circumstance was that anything you could do to create a little space, time, or support was worth doing. I met Mab's implacable gaze and said, "It is necessary to set one condition." Her eyes narrowed.
"What condition?"
"Back up," I said. "I want an extra pair of eyes along, someone of my choosing."
"Why?"
"Because Nicodemus is a murderous, murdering murderer," I said. "And if he's picking a crew, they're going to be just as bad. I want another set of eyes along to make sure one of them doesn't shoot me in the back the second I'm not looking. You're loaning out the Winter Knight, after all. You're not throwing him away." Mab arched an eyebrow.
"Hmm."
"Out of the question, I fear," Nicodemus said. "Plans have already been made, and there's no room for extraneous personnel."
Mab turned her head very slowly to Nicodemus.
"As I remember it," she said, her tone arctic, "when you loaned me your service, you brought your spawn with you. I believe this request exhibits symmetry."
Nicodemus narrowed his eyes. Then he inhaled deeply and inclined his head very slightly in agreement.
"I do not have explicit authority over everyone involved. I can make no promises as to the safety of either your knight or his additional associate."
Mab almost smiled.
"And I can make none as to yours, Sir Arcleone, should you betray an arrangement made in good faith. Shall we agree to an explicit truce until such time as your mission is complete?"
Nicodemus considered that for a moment before nodding his head. "Agreed."
"Done, then," Mab said, and plucked the card from my fingers. "Shall we go, my knight?"
I stared hard at Nicodemus and his bloody-mouthed daughter for a moment. Deirdre's hair rasped and rustled, slithering against itself like long, curling strips of sheet metal. Like hell was I going to help that lunatic. But this was not the time or place to make that stand.
"Yeah," I said through clenched teeth. "Okay."
And without ever quite turning my back on the Denarians, I followed Mab back to the elevator. At the bottom of the elevator ride, I turned to Mab's bodyguards and said, "Time for you guys to get out and bring the car around." When none of them moved, I said, "Okay, you guys filled out some kind of paperwork for how you want your remains disposed of, right?"
At that, the she blinked. They looked at Mab. Mab stared ahead. I'd seen statues that indicated their desires more strongly.
They got out. I waited until the elevator doors closed behind them, flicked a finger, and muttered, "Hexus," unleashing a minor effort of will as I did. Mortal wizards and technology don't blend. Just being in proximity to a wizard actively using magic is enough to blow out a lot of electronics. When a wizard is actually trying to blow out tech, not much is safe. The elevator's control panel let out a shower of sparks and went dark. The light bulbs went out with little pops, along with the emergency lights, and the elevator's interior was suddenly plunged into darkness, lit only by a bit of daylight seeping in beneath the door.
"Are you out of your mind?" I demanded of Mab, quietly.
There was just enough light to show me the glitter of her eyes as she turned them to me.
I am not going to help that dick, I snarled.
You will perform precisely as instructed.
I will not, I said. I know how he works. Whatever he's doing, it's nothing but bad news. People are going to get hurt, and I'm not going to be part of that. I'm not going to help him.
It is obvious to me that you did not listen to me very carefully, Mab said.
It is obvious to me that you just don't get it, I replied. There are things you just don't do, Mab. Helping a monster like that get what he wants is one of them.
Even if refusing costs you your life? She asked.
I sighed. Have you even been paying attention the past couple of years? Do you have any doubt that I would rather die than become part of something like that?
Her teeth made a white gleam in the dark.
And yet, here you are.
Do you really want to push this? I asked. Do you want to lose your shiny new knight already?
Hardly a loss if he will not fulfill a simple command, Mab said.
I'll fulfill commands. I've done it before.
In your own inept way, yes, Mab said.
Just not this one.
You will do precisely as instructed, Mab said.
She took a very small step closer to me.
Or there will be consequences.
I swallowed. The last night, to anger Mab, had wound up begging me to end his life. The poor bastard had been grateful.
What consequences? I asked.
The parasite, Mab said. When it kills you and emerges, it will seek out everyone you know, everyone you love, and it will utterly destroy them, starting with one child in particular.
Goose flesh erupted along my arms. She was talking about Maggie, my daughter.
She's out of this, I said in a whisper. She's protected.
Not from this, Mab said, her tone remote. Not from a being created of your own essence, just as she is. Your death will bring a deadly creature into the world, my knight. One who knows all that you know of your allies, lovers, family.
No, it won't, I said. I'll go back to the island. I'll instruct Alfred to imprison it the moment it breaks free.
Mab's smile turned genuine. It was considerably scarier than her glare.
Oh, sweet child, she shook her head. What makes you think I shall allow you to return?
I clenched my fists along with my teeth.
You bitch.
Mab slapped me.
Okay, that doesn't convey what happened very well. Her arm moved, her palm hit my left cheekbone, and an instant later the right side of my skull smashed into the elevator door. My head bounced off it like a ping-pong ball, my legs went rubbery, and I got a really, really good look at the marble tile floor of the elevator. The metal rang like a gong and was still reverberating a couple of minutes later when I slowly sat up. Or maybe that was just me.
I welcome your suggestions, questions, thoughts, and arguments, my knight, Mab said in a calm voice. She moved one foot gracefully and rested the tip of her high heel against my throat. She put a very little bit of her weight behind it, and it hurt like hell. But I am Mab, mortal. It is not your place to judge me. Do you understand?
I couldn't talk. With her heel nudging my voice box, I jerked my head in a short nod.
Defy me if you will, she said. I cannot prevent you from doing so, if you are willing to pay the price for it.
And with that, she removed her foot from my throat. I sat up and rubbed at it. This is not a smart way to maintain a good professional relationship with me, I croaked.
Do I seem stupid to you, my knight? She asked. Think.
I eyed her. Mab's voice was perfectly calm. After what I'd said to her, the defiance I'd offered her, I hadn't expected that. She had never been shy about showing her outrage when she felt it had been earned. This perfect poise was not out of character precisely, but I had expected a good deal more intensity than she was displaying. My defiance endangered her plans, and that never left her in a good mood. Unless... I closed my eyes and ran back through her words in my head.
Your precise instructions, I said slowly, were to go with Nicodemus and help him until such time as he completed his objective.
Indeed, Mab said, which he stated was to remove the contents of a vault.
She leaned down, took a fistful of my shirt in her hand, and hauled me back to my feet, as easily as she might heft a chihuahua.
I never said what you would do after.
I blinked at that, several times. I dropped my voice.
You want me to double-cross him?
I expect you to repay my debt by fulfilling my instructions, Mab replied. After that, her smile returned, smug in the shadows, I expect you to be yourself.
Whatever Nicodemus has going this time, you want to stop him too, I breathed. She tilted her head very slightly.
You know he's not going to honor the truce, I said quietly. He's going to try to take me out somewhere along the line. He's going to betray me.
Of course, she said. I expect superior, more creative treachery on your part.
While still keeping your word and helping him? I demanded. Her smile sharpened.
Is it not quite the game? She asked.
In my younger days, I would have relished such a novel challenge.
Yeah, I said. Gee, thanks.
Petulance does not become the winter night, Mab said.
She turned to the elevator doors, which had an enormous dent in them, the same shape as a wizard's noggin. They swept open with a groan of protesting metal.
Do this for me, and I shall ensure the safe removal of the parasite when the task is completed.
Nicodemus, his daughter, and God knows what else is in his crew, I said. I'm working with my hands tied, and you expect me to survive this game?
If you want to live, if you want your friends and family to live, I expect you to do more than survive it, Mab said, sweeping out. I expect you to skin them alive.
Chapter 5
To Mab's credit, Karen Murphy said, she is sort of asking you to do what you're good at.
I blinked. What is that supposed to mean?
You have a tendency to weasel out of these bargains you get yourself into, Harry, she said. You have a history.
Like I shouldn't fight them? I demanded.
You probably should focus more on not getting into them in the first place, she said. But that's just one humble ex-cop's opinion.
We were sitting in Karen's living room, in the little house with the rose garden she'd inherited from her grandmother. She was sipping tea, her spring-muscled body coiled up into a lazy-looking ball at one end of the couch. I sat in the chair across from her. My big gray cat, Mister, was sprawled in my lap, luxuriating and purring while I rubbed his fur.
You've taken good care of him, I said. Thank you. He's good company, she said. Though I wonder if he wouldn't like it better with you.
I moved from Mister's back to rubbing behind his ears exactly the way he liked best. His purr sounded like a miniature motorboat. I hadn't realized how much I'd missed the little furball until he'd come running up and thrown his shoulder against my shins. Mister weighed the next best thing to 30 pounds. I wondered how the diminutive Karen had managed to keep from being knocked down by his affection every time she came home. Maybe she had applied some principle of Aikido out of self-defense.
He might, I said. I'm sort of settled now, and there's nothing on the island big enough to take him. But it's cold out there in the winter, and he's getting older.
We're all getting older, Karen said. Besides, look at him. Mister rolled onto his back and chewed happily at my fingertips, pawing at my arms and hands with his limbs without extending his claws. Granted, he was a battle-scarred old tomcat with a stubbed tail and a notched ear, but damn if it wasn't cute, and I suddenly felt my eyes threaten to get blurry.
Yeah, I said, he's kind of my buddy, isn't he?
Karen's blue eyes smiled at me over the rim of her teacup. Only attitude kept her from being an itty-bitty person. Her golden brown hair was longer than it had been since I could remember offhand, tied back into a ponytail.
She wore yoga pants, a tank top, and a flannel shirt, and had been practicing martial arts forms of some kind when I arrived.
"Of course," she said, "you could do it the other way, too.